Y'all, I just finished Author Accelerator's book coaching course and submitted my materials, and let me tell you, I learned a ton. If you've been listening for a while, you know I spent 5 years as an editor with the New York Times, but I still had a lot to learn about helping writers through the process of taking a book from idea to manuscript, and I loved learning it with the Author Accelerator team. What they taught me has changed my approach to editing completely. I didn't just learn how to help a writer move from one stage of the process to the next. I learned how to help them appreciate how far they've come and feel excited about what's coming next, see their strengths and how they can build on them, and trust me to guide them into the hard work that lies ahead. If you'd like to learn more about coaching, fiction or nonfiction, then you need to visit www.bookcoaches.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone, try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, welcome to the hashtag AmWriting podcast. This is the podcast about writing all the things. It's about writing queries, proposals, short stories, long stories, fiction, nonfiction. Essentially, it is about writing all the things. It is about getting the work done. I am Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and The Addiction Inoculation, and you can find my work at The New York Times and The Atlantic and The Washington Post. And we are without KJ Delantonia and Serena Bowen today, but that is cool because I have two guests with me today that I'm very, very excited to introduce to you. I have two guests, co-authors, so we will be talking a little bit about co-authoring today. My first guest is Scott Carney. I looked a little bit into where I first became acquainted with Scott Carney, and it was because I read his book called The Red Market on the Organ Trade, which, you know, I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, totally my cup of tea. I loved it, loved it, loved it. And I think I went ahead and followed on Twitter or something like that, and we have gotten to know each other since. I do that thing where I go into an ice bath sometimes, and that is also Scott Carney's fault because I read his book, What Doesn't Kill Us and The Wedge, and enjoyed both of them. And I think I have recommended the podcast that his wife, Laura Krantz, does on their shared venture, Fox to Puss. And I'll let Scott sort of interject about that in just a minute. He is a journalist and an anthropologist. He has written for lots of fun places everywhere. He was a contributing editor at Wired. He's written for Outside, for Mother Jones, for Discover, all the places I love best. He has won a really cool award, an ethics award, and I shouted about it to my husband this morning because he wrote an article on kidnapping to adoption trade, which I have not heard and really need to listen to and read and all that sort of stuff. And then we have Jason McLean. He is also a journalist. He has a really cool background. Like, we're definitely going to be talking niche today because this dude has come up with the coolest, most interesting niche. He specializes in stories of conflict and in quote, fragile spaces. And we're going to be talking about that. He also holds the record for the fastest drive across North America from Alaska to Key West. I will be definitely asking about that. Scott and Jason McLean, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Oh my gosh. So one of my favorite things is when authors put sort of the, as you call it, your bits and bobs, your cool details, your, you know, this is where I find out things like, you know, world record holders or, you know, I was a contestant on a Chinese talk show once, that kind of thing. Love that stuff. I highly recommend to authors that you put that on there because that's the stuff that interviewers love, the little cool stuff. So I do have to ask before we do anything else. So how long did it take for you to drive from Alaska to Key West, Florida?
It took about 82 hours in total, and it's the sort of thing that I actually considered not putting it on the website because of the climate implications now. It's something that we could do in 2006, and it was really fun, But unless we were doing some sort of electric vehicle now or something like that, I think it would be a little bit, you know, inappropriate to do. But it was a lot of fun. I did it with a longtime friend of mine, Scott Roker, who since went on to amazing things. He was Obama's national security advisor on counterterrorism. And we just we found the record. We wanted to break it. We broke it. And that was that.
How many speeding tickets? I'm not going to let this overwhelm the interview, but how many speeding tickets?
As part of the rule, you are not allowed to get a speeding ticket or use a radar detector. So that's where we had to do a lot of planning and preparation to miss all of the rush hour zones for cities. And so it,
interesting.
You know, when you start getting into that long of a trip, it's more of an endurance trip. It's not a speed thing. So we had all sorts of, you know, this was before GoPros and things like that. So we're getting notary publics in random towns in Alaska to promise that we were there.
Well, we're going to, this discussion actually leads beautifully into a discussion of the book, because so much of what I want to talk about today has to do with various aspects of organization. And so you are an organized dude. I can just tell that about you. Those of you who are listening to this podcast cannot see, but behind him is a very organized bookshelf. I really want to get into this. The reason I'm having these two on the podcast today is they have written a book, a surprising, brilliant, fascinating book called The Vortex. And it is a book about, the subtitle is A True Story of History's Deadliest Storm, An Unspeakable War and Liberation, essentially a topic that I knew nothing about, which I have to thank you, because there's nothing I'd rather read than a topic I know nothing about so that I can learn a ton. So first I have to ask, as always, co-authoring. How did you two come together? Scott, you have written about stuff I can kind of see the through line. Like, when I love to look at like what an author has done and sort of see how one thing may have led to another. And with you, Scott, I can see, you know, interest in, you know, one thing leads to another. But how did you end up here, and how did you mm-hmm. and Jason come together?
Yeah, I mean, the story is, it's quite interesting, because Jason and I actually have known each other for pretty close to 18 years, I think, at this point. And we met at the University of Wisconsin-Madison when I was trying to become a professor of anthropology. I was sort of in my first or second year of a PhD program. And Jason was an undergrad, you know, sort of an elder undergrad in there. And we met in a Hindi class.
Of course.
And of course we met in a Hindi class, right? And it so happened that as the years progressed, I got fed up with anthropology, could not take the idea of being an academic, and dropped out to become a journalist. Whereas Jason, you know, marched forward, finished up University of Wisconsin with, you know, with great aplomb, went to LSE, and he actually is the one who became the professor, and he moved to Oslo, and now he's one of the, you know, best known peace and conflict researchers in the world. And but our friendship has surprisingly stayed pretty strong, and we had decided to do articles together when I was living in India, when I was writing my book, The Red Market, about organ trafficking. We would meet up probably once every couple years to co-write an article. And we, you know, some of them took us into like these war zones in central India. But another one took us onto the border of Bangladesh and India, where India had just built a wall around the entire country. And we were telling the story of a 13-year-old girl who got shot while trying to cross over the border. Her body hung on that wall for a long time. And you know, that story, which was in Foreign Policy, was sort of a big deal to talk about border struggles between India and Bangladesh. But the real question that sort of started this book was, why would India build a wall around the entirety of Bangladesh? Like, what was that all about? And it turns out that in 1970, there was this devastating storm that killed 500,000 people in the course of a few hours, and then sent tidal waves of refugees into India. And India was pretty sure this is going to happen again because of climate change, because of all the everything you know about Bangladesh probably has to do with climate change, right? And India is preparing to basically stem the tide with a wall of very, very angry border guards. And that's how this sort of our relationship started, and also how the origin of this book.
there's some amazing... one of my favorite things about being a writer is getting to do all of the wonky, geeky, dorky research and translate it for people who don't want to do all of the wonky, dorky research. And so much of what you did here, I definitely want to talk about organization, but I also want to talk about narrative structure and how you chose the stories. I mean, when you talk about 500,000 people dead, when you talk about a place as densely populated as the places you're talking about in this story, and, you know, your story sort of bounces around from various places. I so appreciated the map at the beginning of the book because 1970 geopolitics is different from 2022 geopolitics, and the area looks a little different. So that was really, really helpful to me, and I really appreciated that. But Jason, can you talk a little bit about sort of when you've got these massive big questions? I mean, we're talking about climate, we're talking about politics, we're talking about borders, we're talking about, you know, individual stories. How on earth, out of all of the millions of stories you could have chosen, did you choose these? And just for the people listening, we have, and I have to point out, if you're going to talk about politics in the areas that you're talking about, you know, using soccer as a way to get into those stories is never a bad idea. Soccer is a fantastic way to get into those stories. But you have all kinds of really interesting, I want to say characters, but people who help you tell this story, and how on earth you choose the most effective human beings in order to get at that story can be really difficult. And keeping in mind this whole time that it's not just you choosing, it's Jason and Scott choosing. So how did you two land on these?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Thanks for asking it. And I think it gets back to the very notion of, you know, what we were trying to achieve from the beginning, as Scott said, and also Scott's kindness in not mentioning, you know, me, especially coming from the academic background. You know, when I started writing with Scott, I was all, you know, commas and passive voice, five line sentences, you know, just this, like, just the worst.
Let me refer to every single article that has ever existed about this topic before I make my point, so that you will know that I am the most, that I've read everything. Yes, exactly.
No, so the first step for me was actually learning how to write again, because academic writing and popular writing or writing for a mass audience can be very different things. And especially for academics, when you have success writing academic articles, you think you know how to write, and you yeah. and you do, but it's for a different audience. So for me, like, really understanding narrative arcs and character arcs was a really important early component, even before we found the people that we wanted to tell the story through, for me to really understand how we can tell the story through people, how we can bring emotion in. And for me personally, it was reading similar books, but it was also looking in the world of screenplays, for example, like Scott Meyer's mm-hmm. Blacklist blog, things like that. So that really, so first I was able to get that kind of change in mentality. And then after that, as we started working through the proposal, you know, Candy was one of the characters that we found quite early on. And of course, Yahya Khan and some of the political people. But what we really wanted were people like Muhammad Hai, who we eventually found, who could tell the story of the cyclone and of the revolution through one person's experience. And that, for us, was the hardest person to find. We interviewed, I think, over 100 people who said that they had both of those experiences, but many of them, you know, maybe didn't quite live through the storm, though, especially not the way that High did, or they weren't as consequential in the revolution itself. So that was the biggest challenge that we had in finding characters to fit the story we wanted to tell was, you know, first of all, do these people actually exist? And second of all, do they have that story that will allow us to bring it out and connect it in the way that we did?
Yeah, the problem with this book is, like, when we started, we wanted to tell the story of climate change as a nonfiction action thriller, right? We wanted to make this cinematic.
Glad you said that, because, and Jason said it too, like, this book is so cinematic. Not only do you use, you know, the act, blah, 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 but It is, in fact, I watched it last night. We watched episode 2 of Station 11, and I saw all of these similarities between your flashing around from a temporal and a narrative standpoint, and it was, I wrote down cinematic like 10 times while I was reading this book, because it really does. I was going to say, you know, if someone hasn't snapped up the rights to this, I hope someone does, because it is all there in terms of how you would lay this out. And it really works beautifully for this book, because sometimes people try to do that and it feels like it's working too hard. It's driving the narrative. Mm-hmm. Whereas for this, it is just a beautiful way to lay out the narrative. So sorry about interrupting you, Scott, but cinematic is exactly how I would describe this book.
I mean, from your lips to Steven Spielberg's ears, right?
It's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. I remember there was this time in when we were in Dhaka, and we just found Muhammad Hai, we just found Hafez Adin Ahmad, who's the soccer player, and we knew we had the characters, and we, you know, when we wrote the proposal, we prayed we would find the characters, but then we knew we had them, and then we were looking at each other in this hotel room. Which was a weird hotel room. I should tell you its architecture at some point. But we were saying, well, how do you organize a movie? Like, what does a 3-act structure really look like? Yeah. Is this going to be a 5-act structure? And what is a 5-act structure? And we had this, you know, probably like a 3-hour discussion where we're just mapping out character arcs, because we knew roughly what they had done over the course of this 2 or 3 year period. But how do you intersect them all? And are chapters that are only 5 pages long at most really going to captivate people, mm-hmm. or not? And, you know, we have, I guess, is it 5 main characters, Jason? I think we have 5 main characters who we follow, and interweaving it all without getting someone confused is a very difficult proposition. And you know, we sort of thought we were getting into like a Game of Thrones situation here, but it really did work out. And I have to just compliment Jason for a second. Jason was responsible for the bulk of that first draft. I mean, we arced out everything, but it's easier to write a book where you have one voice and then you add another voice mm-hmm. on top versus 2 people doing things. I mean, I was responsible for certain sections, but Jason did the bulk, and it just worked out really, really well, especially once we figured out what the bones of this this whole project would look like.
I go into, for both of my proposals, for both of my books, I think I went in knowing who the narrative framing character was going to be for 60% of my chapters. But then sometimes when you're doing the research after you've sold the book on proposal, certain stories will just sort of appear, suddenly land in your lap. Did you have any of that going on, or did you go into this with everything really tightly nailed down?
No, it was not tightly nailed down. Jason, tell the story of how we found Muhammad Hai.
Okay. Yeah. So I have and Scott knows him too. There's a fantastic human rights lawyer based in Dhaka, who has worked as my research assistant for several academic projects. Scott and I worked with him on a foreign policy piece we did together, and he his name is Reza Rahman. He's worked so much with us on the Vortex as well. So we had, you know, we'd written this proposal. We said we had someone who could maybe do this. Hafez was not in the proposal at all. So we had the idea. We were able to sell the idea. But as Scott said, yeah, no, this wasn't a tightly nailed down proposal. You know, a few months in, we're like, okay, we really have to find this person that's going to bring these pieces together. And we really hope that we can do that. So we ran through a bunch of leads, nothing really panned out. So eventually Scott and I had the idea, like, what if we just put an ad out in the newspaper?
Interesting.
You know, we thought there must be people who lived through both the storm and, you know, fought in the Liberation War. But a lot of the stories just focused on one or the other. So we put the ad out in a main Dhaka paper, and also in a paper that got a lot of circulation in Mampura, the island where Hai was from. And poor, wonderful Reza, he had to sit through hundreds of people calling him. You know, we're talking like lonely 75-year-old dudes who haven't told this story and they just wanted someone to talk to. He got calls from military people. He got calls from relatives.
Okay, I have to stop you. I have to stop you for a second. So doing this, I'm assuming that most of these people are going into this thinking that they're essentially selling their story and that you're going to pay them to be an interview subject. And how did that conversation go?
Yeah, and that's something we actually put in the interview the advertisement itself, that this isn't for pay. This is for collecting stories. This is for, you know, serious, you know, academic work, which it also is. It's a really important thing because, yes, of course, why wouldn't people think that they are going to get paid for this? And then, of course, the other element of that is, okay, so now we found several people who might work. And then we interviewed, I would say, like 7 or 8 people who made our quote-unquote shortlist. But there were a few of them, of course, who were just telling stories to tell stories. You know, once you start asking for the details, things start to fall apart. So there was a big multi-month triangulation process to make sure that Muhammad Hai's story in particular was as truthful as he says it was, that he was in the places that he said he was. When you put out an ad in the paper, you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah. Well, and there's absolutely no precedent whatsoever for the subject of nonfiction for journalism to make up any stories that then torpedoes the career of the journalist in question. That never, ever happens. And definitely not notably.
And one of the other things that showed up, though, is some of these people, you know, we had lots of sources and some of these people had amazing stories, but they didn't click all the boxes. Like they had a great survival story from the storm, but they didn't take up arms in the revolution that comes up later. But, you know, we were very tempted of making a fully composite character of the best materials. One story that I remember that's lightning clear is, you know, this storm surge was 20 feet tall, right? So the island was completely submerged. Almost everyone drowned except for the people who climbed into the trees.
Well, and for the listener and for people who haven't read this book, I mean, the territory that you're talking about, much of it is about 10 feet above sea level, right? I mean, you're talking
one foot. And so one of the stories, though, is this guy climbs up a tree and he lives out the storm. And when he climbs up the tree, he finds it's full of king cobras because they're also trying to escape the storm.
Of course.
And so we have a scene, what we could have put in the book, of a guy holding on for his life with snakes, deadly snakes next to him. And he survives. But, you know, we didn't end up doing that, which I think says something about our journalistic integrity. There was a discussion. But it turned out that, you know, we did find this guy who did survive the storm. He saw his whole family die in the cyclone and then ended up taking up, he was part of the aid effort and then he was instrumental in the revolution that followed. And for Hafez, we also got very lucky. Hafez is our soccer player who was a soccer star. And he is, in Bangladesh, he's actually a little bit of a controversial person because he is a part of the BNP, which is basically the Republicans of Bangladesh, right? Separate these two into two different parties. We have the Republicans and Democrats. He's basically in the Republicans of Bangladesh, and a lot of people really don't like him. But his story was so amazing because he was this soccer star who was a reluctant hero. Like, he really did not want to be in part of politics at all, and he sort of gets forced not only to leave soccer but to join the Pakistani military. And when the Pakistani military starts murdering people, he leads a mutiny, and it's all like, oh my God, do I have to do this now? It's his basic feeling at every part of this. And we left the book off at the, you know, the book ends with the liberation of Bangladesh. Bangladesh actually gets established after these traumatic events. And we leave the book off at the absolute height where everyone's like, yes, rah, rah, this is perfect. And then some of these characters get a little bit more questionable in the 3 or 4 years afterwards.
The afterward, I just have to say, works so brilliantly because it gives you a really great opportunity to do the, you know, the 1,000-mile-high post-game analysis of, you know, here's all of the things we've been talking about through this book. And in case you didn't fully understand the ramifications, let me now explain it to you. The other thing that worked really well was having people who narrative subjects who were, you know, on the island in the epicenter, like in landfall right there, cows in trees, people in trees, you know, really bad stuff. A woman, Candy, who is like, ooh, there's a storm coming. Oh, next day there are some puddles kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And a meteorologist who sees the storm track and freaks out and realized, oh, holy crap, this happened 7 days ago. Where did we fall down on, on this? And how can we? Because the whole point of this book is that a storm is not just a storm. A storm is, and that's the vortex is such a perfect title for this. And I do have to ask, who came up with the title? Because it's perfect. It's perfect. Because it's not only, because it's so perfect because it gets at the fact that there is a vortex, but that there is so much, other stuff that gets sucked in. Also, I can't not ask this question. And I thought about it many times. The fact that Candy's in the book begs the question of you, Jason, and you, Scott, to white men telling this story. Candy is a very cool character. She is a well-meaning character. She makes all the mistakes, and yet her heart is in the right place. She's at the epicenter of this because she's living in East Pakistan with her husband, who does cholera research. And she is a boots on the ground kind of person who is faced with, you know, how do I do the things that need to be done in this situation from a humanitarian, from a, you know, all kinds of different angles, perspective, while operating within this political climate. And, you know, over and over again, it kept sort of smacking me in the face that this is not just a white American woman, but a white American woman named Candy, which is just too perfect. And so I have a twofold question. It begs the question of who gets to tell stories. And number two, did Candy know going into it that she would be this person who would be pointed out as the white woman in the story of a region that's non, that, you know, of a region that's not hers, that she does not necessarily naturally belong to?
No, and that's another really, really important question. And of, you know, of course, reading the book, it's not just about Candy, but can we tell the story of Bengalis as two white right. men as well? So, I mean, we have many different characters who on their own, it could be very problematic. And we worked a lot and thought a lot about these issues. For Candy first, you know, thankfully Candy had written a memoir, so we could get a lot of Candy's material in her own words. And we're not making, suppositions or judgments upon her actions, which is really, really important, because there were several times, I think, especially in earlier drafts, Scott, where we would put in material that was based upon Candy's memoir, and then it would look like a cliche of a woman in the 1960s.
Right.
So, you know, although it, you know, this is true material, it can come off in a way that's a little bit different, that looks a little bit different today. So,
well, and I love that there are elements of that sort of cliched appearance, but you actually address them in the book, which is great. You sort of say, you know, she is of a very specific political and chronological, you know, a certain era. And it was really great that instead of just pretending like it didn't exist, you did talk about it, which was great.
And we also talked with, Candy very sadly passed away during the writing of the book. But we talked with her husband, John, quite a bit. And, you know, I would say 7, 8, 9 of her friends who were with her at the time, specifically about personality issues and her positionality, and basically asking, do we have this right? Is this what Candy was about? And that, that, of course, took some time, and we had to make some changes to things that we assumed from her memoir. But we believe that, you know, again, as two white guys, we wrote this to the best of our own ability, and we did what we could to try to bring Candy's voice out. And this is exactly what we also did with Muhammad High and our main Bengali characters as well. And that included sensitivity reads from Bengalis.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah, we've interviewed sensitivity readers before. It's such a it's a new thing that, you know, this didn't exist until just recently. And that was going to be my very next question of whether you worked with one.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had actually three different sensitivity reads from three different Bengalis on this book, specifically looking at those sorts of things. And also in the way that we wrote it, we wanted it to be of a more reporting nature. So, you know, there was material that we could have put in about, let's say, like we could have written for pages on Bengali culture and the greatness of Bengali culture, but it just, it wouldn't have been necessarily true to the characters. So we tried to keep it to what we definitely knew and what we could source, and what also was authentic coming from our position.
That actually works really well as well. I was talking about how, in fact, last night when we were watching Station 11, we were talking about how you get exposition into the story. And, you know, there are people that do it and smack you across the face. And then there are people that sort of allow the exposition to happen naturally. So having people like Candy, who is somewhat new to a country, and having her be able to explain some of the things that a Western audience might not understand was really great. It, you know, I don't know if that was a matter of convenience or planning, but it was a fantastic way, you know, to have like a person who can explain things to me, because there were lots of things that needed to be explained to me. Okay, we get a lot of questions about organizing research. We get a lot of questions about, and I'm going to start with, on a practical level, you have two different households, two different countries, two different offices, two different sets of file folders, digital and paper, and two sets of post-it notes littering the office wall. How did you two as co-authors organize your research for yourselves and for each other?
I want to say that Google Docs is a miracle worker.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we can, especially for the first draft, you can sort of live see what the other person is working on.
Yeah.
And you can put comments on, and it makes it very, very easy to sort of like collaborate in a way that it's much more difficult in Word or Scrivener or one of these other other programs. Right. So that was enormous for the first draft. And we also shared a Google Drive folder where all the research went in. And also, you know, remember Jason, you know, we did separate out different characters that we were going to take charge of, but Jason did the sort of the bulk of that initial draft after we put the bones in, so that his brain, whatever or happens in his brain, which actually I have questions myself. that voice comes in from him, and then I come in and then, you know, add the chorus, and then we sort of go back and forth. And yeah, it's surprising that it did work. And we only swore at each other like 40 or 50 times over the course of the 5-year period we were working on this.
One of the games I like to play, my co-host Serena Bowen is a best-selling, like many times over best-selling romance author, and she often co-writes. And one of the games I like to play, knowing Serena so well and knowing her voice so well, is to try to pick out her words apart from her. And sometimes it just comes down to like references that she would make that someone else might not make. I have to say, your writing is really seamless. I couldn't pick apart, you know, who wrote what. It was really well done.
That was the one thing I think that we were really lucky about. And we didn't quite know that for sure. There was, you know, for me, one of the big moments was when I first sent, I think it was the, because I wrote it like one character at a time for the rough draft. And, you know, with a book like this, where we're also getting into, you know, nearly 1,000 different sources, having two people do distinct deep dives would have caused such a mess when we tried to get it back together, because we would have found different things. And it just, the way that we ended up doing it, it worked out. But, you know, when I first sent, I think it was the Muhammad High pieces to Scott, and he could see, okay, yeah, this is similar enough to the way I write, you know, and we'd written smaller pieces together before. But that's when we really started to see, okay, this is how we'll go together. And, you know, our voices on the page were similar enough that that we were able to get that similarity. And then the second point was really when our first editor, Denise Oswald, read it. That was such a enlightening moment, I think, for me and Scott, because that was the first independent assessment who could say, okay, you guys really were able to pull this thing off, which
it was the nicest letter. It was the nicest letter I've ever gotten in the course of my career. She was like, oh my God, this is a good book. And like, usually editors don't do that. And we both read it. We're like, oh my God, we're real.
I am not ashamed to say that I have taken screenshots of comments from my editor where, you know, my editor and my agent, you know, they're not my emotional support people. They're not there to talk me up. They're there to help me with the hard work. So when I get a comment like that, I'm not ashamed to say I take screenshots. I have them in my photos files.
It's not framed on my wall or anything.
All right. So here's a question that I have asked and answered multiple times on the podcast because it is very, and I've asked this so many times of other people, how do you know when you're done with the research and you can start the writing? How do you know when you have enough? And Jason, for a lot of this material, this is right in your wheelhouse. So it's, you know, it's not like for me, sometimes I have to, like with my second book, I had to learn an entire new area of expertise in order to write about it. So it's a matter of like, when can I see the forest for the trees kind of thing. But for both of you, how did you, when, and Scott, this is, a lot of this was new to you, I would assume, since your area of expertise is not the same as Jason's. How did you feel that you were ready to stop reading more articles and start writing?
Well, it's a great question because I think Jason and I have actually two totally divergent philosophies on this.
Interesting.
As a person who's written four books before this one, I have, in my very first book, I was the deep dive. I became the world expert on organ trafficking. Like, I knew everything. I was the guy. If you want to talk about how a kidney moves illegally,
right.
I'm the guy.
Yeah, you should see my cutting room floor. It is littered with details that no one will ever need to know. Yeah.
Right. But then I realized at some point in my career that a book is 300-ish pages. This one's, I guess, 500. And you only need to know, like, concretely the words in the book. Anything else is extraneous. So my philosophy on a book is you really only have to be about 10 inches deeper than what the book has. Now, an academic like Jason believes that he should be dredging the Marianas Trench with his research. And I think that there was a back and forth, which worked out amazing because I would pull him out of some of these holes and he would be like, no, let's go down this hole a little bit more. And then we also had the sort of mutual fact checking thing that went on because I would, you know, when we were reading the book, we tried to verify and look at things. So I wonder because we're planning a next book right now. Ooh. And I'm wondering how Jason will approach the next book having done this book.
Much deeper dive. We're going to take 14 years. No, it's funny because when you asked that question, my immediate thought was like, okay, when do I know I'm done? And it was basically for this book when Scott says I'm done. Because he can take that like more neutral view of things. No, but like the other thing I really learned was that we don't need to be the world's expert on the 1971 war. There are many, many fantastic books that have already been written by people to do that. What we need to be is the world's expert on the characters we wrote about, on those people. So once that kind of changed in my head, like I don't need to know every single detail of this time, but I do need to know every single detail of the people we're telling the story through. That made a much more natural break where we could very easily see when we were reaching the point of marginal returns.
I think the reason that I'm an over-researcher is that I come at this as having been a teacher for 20 years, and I need to anticipate the questions I might get from my students in the classroom, which, because I was a middle school teacher, could be everything from, yeah, but how does that Elizabethan guy button his pants? Oh, wait, buttons haven't been invented yet. Let's go research that more. I need to be the expert. I always did feel like I needed to be the expert because a middle school student can ask any question on the planet. So I totally sympathize with your dredging efforts because that's how I feel like I need to do it too. And then my editor comes back with notes in the margin that say, yeah, your reader doesn't care, or jargon, or no one needs to know this, that kind of thing. So, or my my two best friends who I send all of the useless information to. They know all of the things too. So, I still can't, you know, even now after talking to you, still can't imagine getting my arms around such a large subject. But one of the things that works so well, I think, always in nonfiction about really complex topics is to show, number one, how they affect individual human beings. You got to pick the right individual human beings in order to tell the story from various perspectives. And you just did a marvelous job with that. Here is a big question. You are coming at this, you're going to do this again from the lips of Scott Carney. What would you do differently? What are you going to do differently? What do you hope will go differently? What worked this time around? And what will you change for next time? Now that you have experience writing these books, this book together, what will you do differently and what will you do the same?
That's such a pertinent question because Jason, like right after this call, I am looking at the book proposal that Jason has been working on for a month, and it's the official handoff happens in 15 minutes.
Your editor called me right before this call and asked me to ask that question. So.
You know, I don't know if things actually will change that much because one of the processes of writing a book is training each other how you both work. And I think that having written a book together, there was a lot of conflict at various points. For instance, Jason loves passive voice and I'm like, no, let's use active voice. Now he's getting much, much better at that. It's just like coming on the page much better. And there's a chance that he might make me obsolete. So now I have to find other things to go after him for, which I'm working on. So maybe that's what it is. I'm trying to find better things to critique Jason on in the future.
Well, you know... I don't know if I want to say related to that, but you know, there were going through this for the first time, there was a lot of uncertainty. Like, are we going to pull this off? Will this person that has been my friend for almost 20 years actually, like, you know, deliver in those key moments? You know, things like that mm-hmm. that you just don't know until you go through.
Right.
Now, knowing that we've gone through it, you know, we have a totally different mentality. We might work a little bit more on particular elements. But yeah, it's a difficult question because we are at the point, and it's a terrible time to ask us this question because we're at the point where we're all like, yay, it worked, and we're all happy. So, you know, if you asked us this maybe a year ago, we'd probably have a very different answer. We would probably definitely have said, no, we're never working together again. Are you crazy?
That happened. I said those words before.
Well, and from Jason, I mean, from the perspective of an academic, it can be really... So one of the things, we happen to both be under the umbrella of HarperCollins. Yours is Echo, HarperCollins Publishers. I'm with Harper Books. One of the things Harper does in order to not be... So books are not perceived as academic books and have a more public appeal, more, you know, popular audience appeal, they use things, techniques like key phrase call out. So you have to have a key phrase and then your citation, and there's no, for example, footnotes or any, right. You know, in so lack of footnotes can be, you know, a thing. And I, you know, I had to learn my resource management tool for my bibliography and all that sort of stuff. Those things are evolving skills. And, you know, writing books like these, it having to come together and write a book where one person is like, oh, where are all the footnotes? And another person is like, you know, oh, we need to have, you've always had an index and you've always had great references, Scott. So I don't mean to imply you, but someone who has only written for a popular audience, for example, might come to this and say, why do we need to back up every single statement with a key phrase call out? And for listeners, key phrase call out, if you go to the back of a nonfiction book for popular consumption, you'll see that like the line, and the storm raged on, might have a, you know, a reference to exactly a meteorologic study about how long and how strong the storm was and that kind of thing. So instead of having a footnote, which is perceived as boring and dry and academic, HarperCollins can get around doing things like that. So the nuts and bolts of bringing two people together from two very different disciplines is they're not minor things, and it's a big learning curve. So I really
we had really serious impressed. throwdown fights over that very question, because I am much less like the way I have written all of my books is I list all my sources in the back and I don't cite anything in particular unless I mention it in a sentence, like I found this book said this,
right?
And that will be it'll be a direct call out in the text. And my feeling is that we don't need any of that because we're telling a great story. And Jason is like, if we don't cite it, I'm going to get lose tenure, yeah, whatever he's, yeah, thinking. So this, yeah, is a throwdown fight for sure.
Well, and I learned the hard way that some people will say, now, where did that come from? And then you're like, oh my God, where did that come from? Ah, mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm an endnotes gal. I'm a endnotes? Bookends. I'm a bookends gal, by the way, just, you know, just for resource management purposes. Go ahead. Anyway, sorry, Jason.
No, I was just going to say that, yeah, thankfully it all worked out in the end, because from the beginning, like for me especially, you know, we wanted to make a book that the, you know, that the public would love, but also that academics respected. So for me, I'm in a little bit different position than Scott. I like, if I'm going to make a book like this, if it's going to be something that's in the popular eye, I also want to be see academics in the field saying, yeah, the bones of this book are really, really solid. The research, yeah, is there, and I can see that research. For me, it looks so much cleaner and nicer on the page if the footnotes and endnotes are in the format that they are in the Vortex. But
which brings up a good point. Do you think you two have different, like, I always have an ideal reader in mind. Do you think you had different ideal readers in mind?
I don't think so.
I think we had the same ideal reader.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Cool. We have run so over time. We don't have time to talk about what we've been reading, all of that stuff. But I could talk about this book for another 2 hours simply because you talked at the very beginning about, you know, a 3-hour conversation about figuring out how this was going to work. This is going to be going in my, we call it on the podcast, we talk a lot about dissecting other people's work. When you find either you need a certain voice or you need to figure out a structure, I literally will go into a book and dissect it and totally, you know, highlight or note, okay, this is the structure of how they got from point A to point B in a really effective manner. And I think this is going to be a book that I will be recommending for deep dive, broad topic, wonky topic sort of investigation, because it's beautifully done. It's a book worthy of dissection, truly worthy of dissection for people who like that sort of thing. So bravo to both of you for that. Did we get to talk about everything you want to talk about, or is there anything you want to add before we get out of here?
Oh, I agree with you. This could be a 3-hour conversation because I feel like yeah, in some ways there's so much that goes into writing a book. You know, we're talking about narrative structure, but there's also like sort of the business side of this stuff, how it actually came together with agents and two different agencies and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I was going to ask about all of that too. Like the agent question was a whole other line of questioning. I was going to get into all of that shopping, how the proposal was structured. Did you go with the full proposal or a short proposal? All of that mm-hmm. stuff. So maybe we'll have to do this again because I think there's a lot of fertile ground that our listeners are particularly interested in. So I think this is going to be a really, when we first started this podcast, we wanted to be as helpful as possible and flatten the learning curve for people who were looking to become writers. And I think this episode is going to be really great for that. So I'm really grateful to both of you.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having us on and being a fan since 11 years ago when The Red Market came out. Like, when you said that, I could not believe it. I was like, oh my God, I have known you for 11 years.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. I've loved all of your books, but that was my introduction to Scott Carney, and it's still on my bookshelf. I really love that book. And I'm a new fan of Jason Miklian, so I'm going to have to, you know, brush up on my academic cred and read some of his articles.
Thank you so much. This has been a real, real pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Cool. Thank you so much. All right. Until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. The Hashtag Am Writing podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work. Save. Pause. Stop. Aww. Thank you.